Okay, so I've had fun learning with everyone so far the last 2 weeks, and we've tried to pick topics that that thematically connect across the three sections of Shema. Today, the theme that we'll be focusing on appears most prominently in the third section, but also appears in an important way in the first section. And as the title indicates, it's the theme of becoming servants of God as central to understanding Kriyat Shema. So I will note, and I'll mention it again a little bit later, but I do want to get it out there. In the course of our discussion, the third paragraph of Shema does focus on the mitzvah of tzitzit, which, as we'll see, halachically speaking, the obligation devolves upon men and not women. And since, as we will see, the mitzvah of tzitzit is representative of very broad and very fundamental concepts, the obvious question that must be asked is, why is the obligation limited to men and not women? If we have time, we will touch on it, but so that I got it out there, I think that the best treatment that I have found, not just of the halachic issues, but of the philosophical issues that emerge, is from a website that you should all know about, which I'm putting the link now in the chat, Diracha, which Lori Novick spoke for you recently, right?
Yes.
So Diracha is an excellent website run by Lori Novick, who's a Yoetzet Halacha. She lives here a few minutes from me in Efrat. And she runs this organization of talented Talmidot Chachamot, of educated female scholars writing about halachic issues that relate to women. And she has a piece on tzitzit on the website. So if we don't get a chance to cover it in depth, I do encourage you to follow up there. Okay, so let's turn to the sources. So let me share my screen. Okay. So as I said, the theme I want to talk about is becoming servants of God. And as we've talked about Shema, the three paragraphs of Shema, the liturgy as we say it, captures many of the most fundamental ideas of commitment to Torah. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the series, and even more last week, that's the reason that Rabbi Lam has this book, the Shema, Spirituality and Law in Judaism, as using the text of Shema as a springboard for discussing fundamental issues in Jewish philosophy. I once heard from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs that Judaism doesn't really write classic Jewish texts from the Talmudic period. They don't have philosophical treatises. The central philosophical ideas of Judaism are captured in the Siddur. Therefore, a lot of these ideas that are central to our commitment emerge from our classic and fundamental liturgy. So the theme I want to develop appears, as I said, in the first and third paragraph of Shema. But we start, before we look at the text, with a halakha, with a law. So the first source, this is the Mishnah, in the third paragraph of Brachot, tells us that Nashim v'avadim uktanim p'turin mikriyat Shema u'minat tefillin, v'chayavim b'tefila u'vimezuza u'virkat ha'mazon. Women, slaves, and minors, meaning children below 13 or 12, are exempt from reciting Shema and putting on tefillin, but they are obligated for prayer, mezuzah, and birkat hamazon, for grace after meals. And the Yerushalmi picks up on this second law. The reason that women are exempt is, and again, maybe we'll get to this a little bit later, is because of a general exemption that's found in the Talmud from mitzvot aseishas man grama, of time-bound positive commandments. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, and this does not appear in the Bavli, the Yerushalmi asks, Avadim minai, from where do we derive that slaves are exempt from the Shema? So the Yerushalmi responds, Shene Emar, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Because Shema, the opening verse, is, listen, O Israel, God, the Lord our God, is God, He is one. Now, I stopped right there. I would have no idea what the Yerushalmi wants for my life. Meaning, where does one see in the Pasuk, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, that only free people are obligated to say the Shema? So the Yerushalmi here pulls a fascinating move of philosophical halachic exegesis and says as follows. On the assumption that Shema is a commitment, is an acceptance of our service of God, so the Yerushalmi says, Et she'ein lo adon ela hakadosh baruch hu. Yatsa ha'eved she'yesh lo adon acher. Only one who has but one master, i.e. God, only such a person can recite the Shema in good faith, but a servant cannot because he has an intermediate master, however you want to understand it, and therefore he cannot be obligated in the Shema. Now this line in the Yerushalmi is fascinating and shocking. Now, we are talking here not about Jewish slaves, not an Eved Ivri, we should clarify. In Halakha, there are two types of slaves. There's an Eved Ivri, which is a Jew who either sells himself or is sold into slavery. Such a slave is obligated in all mitzvot, or at least that's how it's generally understood. And his slavery is interpreted in Jewish law as more indentured servitude, and it's not as complete as non-Jewish servitude. An Eved Kenani has a more complete servitude. His obligation and mitzvot is partial. Upon his manumission, upon his emancipation, upon being freed, he becomes, or she becomes, a complete Jew or Jewess with all of the obligations that are entailed. But in their state of servitude, their obligations are incomplete. And that's the type of servant that we speak of. And the Yerushalmi says that such a servant cannot be obligated to say the Shema, because the Shema, it sounds like, is a commitment of God as our master. And as incredible as it sounds, the Yerushalmi says that a servant or a slave who is not in complete control of what he does, he cannot really commit. There's something lacking in his ability to commit to God because he has obligations to his master, and therefore he cannot be obligated to say Shema. And what the Yerushalmi seems to be saying, and again, I think this is shocking at many levels, but also instructive, is that Shema at its core is not just a commitment of faith, but it's a commitment of action. It's a commitment to a lifestyle in which everything we do is determined by, or is weighed against the standard of our obligations to God. And the Yerushalmi says, if you were to have a person who is incapable of really committing every moment of every day to God, even if in their heart they're committed to God, even if they can never violate God's will, but 24/7 they can't actually say every single act I do is determined solely by my commitment to what God says, then that person, there's something lacking when they say the word Shema Yisrael. And this, as I said, is, I think, very, very powerfully driving home the point that Shema is not about faith alone. Because if it was about faith alone, so then everybody can have faith. Everybody can say, I totally and completely believe that there is one God. Right? It doesn't matter if practically I may be limited in my service of God. I can believe in God. I can love God emotionally, intellectually, psychologically, existentially. I can commit. I can connect. If that's what Shema was, and that's all Shema was, so then it doesn't matter how practically limited someone might be in their performance of the actions that manifest that commitment, he would be allowed to say Shema. But the Yerushalmi is clearly telling us that if that's what you think Shema is, you've missed the boat. When you say Shema every morning and every night, you are not committing to a creed alone. You're not committing to a set of dogma, of tenets of faith. You are committing to a lifestyle in a complete and holistic way. And therefore, the Yerushalmi propounds that if you have somebody who that practical commitment is lacking through no fault of his own, then his Shema cannot be complete, and therefore he cannot be obligated in saying Shema. Now, it is worth noting that this type of argumentation does appear in the Bavli, but not in the context of Shema. And if you look at source 3, and this I'll look at the English, if you look at source 3, you'll see in the Gemara and Chagiga 4a, that in the context of the commandment to be Ole Regel, of to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem on the holidays, so there again, slaves are exempt from the obligation to go to Jerusalem. And the Bavli asks, why? However, with regards to slaves, where did we derive that they are exempt? So Rav Huna said that the verse states, before the Lord God, this indicates that one who has only one master is obligated, which excludes the slave who has another master. So the Bavli does have this argumentation, and then it goes through a bit more technicality, which I don't want to get into, but the Yerushalmi does have the Bavli has this argumentation, but it does not believe that it applies to Shema. And it's not totally clear why that is. I gave you, and I don't want to read through them, but I put it here for anyone who's interested. Some of the commentaries try to figure out why it is that the Bavli is willing to entertain such an argument in general, but doesn't apply it to Shema, and the Yerushalmi seems to take this as a controlling principle in several mitzvot. It's a fascinating, very technical discussion, and I gave you several commentaries here, both in the context of Aliyah LaRegel, in the context of Nizirut, of accepting the vow of the Nazirut. But that is, again, a technical discussion, but I put it here just in the Hebrew for anyone who is interested in that. But, again, what I think this highlights is this notion that Shema is not just, as I said, a statement of faith, but as the Yerushalmi suggests, it is a statement of commitment to action, and that's why the Yerushalmi conceptualize it as such, that one who has a limitation on their actions, on their practical manifestation of their commitment to God, there's something lacking in Shema. And therefore, what I think that teaches us is that when we say Shema in the morning, if we think what we're doing is saying, I believe in God, I love God, and that's it, then we've totally missed the boat. It's essentially a pledge of allegiance, but of allegiance meaning practical allegiance. to a set of laws, to a lifestyle. And that's really what lies at the core of Shema. Now, to flesh this out a little bit, I just want to focus for a moment on another statement of Chazal. If you look for a moment at number 10, so the Torah tells us that a slave goes free. Now we're talking about a Jewish slave. A Jewish slave normally has a term of servitude of 6 years. If the slave decides to remain beyond the 6 years of servitude, he has the right to do that. It's not encouraged, as we'll see in a moment. But he has that ability. But during the Yovel, he goes free. During the Jubilee, he goes free. And that's what the Psukim tell us here. Kisachir kitoshav yehi imach, at shnat ha-yovel yavod imach. He shall remain with you as a hired or bound laborer. He will serve you until the Jubilee year. V'yatza me'imach hu vanavimo. And then he will go out during the Jubilee with his family. V'shavel mishpachto v'alchuzar avotav yashuv. He'll return to his family. He'll return to his ancestral holding. Why? Ki avadai heim asher hotzeiti otam eretz mitzrayim lo yimachru mimkeret aved. And the reason, according to the Psukim, is because you are my servants. God says you are my servants, and I took you out of Egypt, and therefore you cannot be a slave forever. And Rashi quotes the Sifrei here and says, Ki avadaihem shtari kodem. Even if someone is entitled to sell himself into slavery and even remain there beyond the 6 years of servitude, God says a Jew can never really be a slave to anybody, because by taking us out of Egypt, he made us into his servants. He took us from being the slaves of Pharaoh, and we became his slaves. And therefore, there is no commitment that we can have that can override that. And you see this idea again in the following law about slavery in number 12. This is the first time the laws of slavery appear in the Torah. Ve'eila mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. Ki tikneh v'divri she'shanen ya'avodu v'ashvi'i yetzei l'chavshi chinam. When you buy a Jewish slave, he'll serve you for 6 years and go free in the seventh for free. Im bigapo yavo bigapo yitze, im bali shahu v'yatza ishto imo. If he came in single, he leaves single. If he entered the slavery married, so he leaves with his family. Im adonav yitin lo isha v'yalda lo vanim uvanot. Ha'isha v'yaladati el adonav hu yitze bigapo. If he marries in the context of the slavery, so then he goes free, but his family does not. But if the slave were to say, I love my master, I love the family that I had within the context of slavery, I don't want to leave, I want to stay a slave. So then, so then his master takes him to the judges, and they take him to the door or the doorpost, and they pierce his ear, and he'll remain a slave for life. And the Gemara comments and he says, why? Why do you pierce his ear? So the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, in Source 13, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai haya doresh al mikra hazeh kimin chomer. Ma nishtana ozen mikol haverim shavagof. Why? Looking at the English, why is the ear different from all the other limbs in the body, as the ear alone is pierced? So the Holy One, blessed be He, said, the ear heard my voice on Mount Sinai when I said, for to me the children of Israel are slaves, which indicates, and they should not be slaves to slaves. And yet this man went and willingly acquired a master for himself, therefore let this ear be pierced. And again, you see this idea that the Torah conceptualizes. Now, I should make a point here that's very important in general. One of my Rebbeim, Moshe Lichtenstein, points out that the Torah not just the Torah, Tanakh in general, has many, many different metaphors that it uses to describe the relationship of the Jewish people and God. And you have to realize that if you focus too much on any metaphor in particular, then you will miss the completeness of the way that we relate to God. But that doesn't mean you ignore the implications of any given metaphor. And it's only the combination of these metaphors that get us even close to understanding the complexity of our relationship with God. So, for example, he notes that sometimes the Torah will describe our relationship with God as a parent and a child. Now he says, what is implied by this relationship? So he says, on the one hand, it has quote-unquote benefits. The benefit of the parental-child relationship, of calling us the children of God, is that we, the love that we show to our children is unconditional. So by calling ourselves the children of God, ostensibly, though technically this is a machloket in Kiddushin, but we'll leave that for now, ostensibly what we're saying is that God loves us unconditionally. So you might say, well, that's great. So then why don't we only refer to ourselves as the children of God? So Ramosha notes that there's a downside, quote-unquote, to this relationship, which is that while it's true that the relationship implies that God loves us unconditionally, it also implies that we are, by definition, inherently in a not a relationship of equals with God, and not a relationship of choice. Right? Children are always going to be secondary to their parents, and they didn't choose to be their parents' child. And therefore, the relationship of parent to children has a benefit that it manifests unconditional love, but it doesn't grant us a relationship of choice. The other metaphor that we have is a metaphor of spouse. Right? We are God's spouse. Now, that has a benefit because it implies, as crazy as it is, that at some level we are God's equal, or at least that we entered into the relationship with God equally. But obviously it has the disadvantage that marriages can be dissolved. Right? There can be divorce, which is why Yeshayahu, which is why Isaiah has to say, yes, you are God's spouse, but even when you're sent into exile, God never gave you a divorce, right? Because we have a Catholic marriage, not a regular marriage. And therefore, the metaphor here of slave to God, I think, has to be taken as part of a broader picture, meaning it's not the only metaphor that we use to understand a relationship with God. And as we come closer to the Yamim Noraim, to the High Holidays, we have the beautiful prayer of Ki Anu Amecha, where we go through all the metaphors. We are your people, you are our king. We are your grapevines, and you are the pruner of the grapevines. We are your sheep, you are our shepherd. We are your spouse, you are our lover, etc. Where we try to, in a very short tefillah, go through 20 different metaphors. But if we focus for a moment on the slave-master metaphor, its power lies in the fact that a slave-master relationship is one that A, is at some level complete, and the second is that it's a relationship that is predicated on action. Right, when we say that we're God's children, we all know that our children are our children whether or not they do what we ask them to do. And they often don't. Right? If when they're young, you ask them to clean up their room, that may or may not happen, but that doesn't change the fact that they are your children. But your servants, if they didn't listen to you, there would be something lacking in their servitude. Because their relationship to you is defined by the fact that they are those people who work for you. And therefore, the relationship, I think, of calling God our master and relating to ourselves as servants is focusing on the fact that as many other relationships we may have with God, which imply that God loves us no matter what, like the child-parent relationship, or certain other relationships which are even more extreme, right? Like God is our shepherd, which implies that we are like animals and we aren't even expected to express free will because we don't have free will. Right, that's what that metaphor implies, that God recognizes that at some level we don't have, it's as if we don't have free will, he's just going to take care of us no matter what. The metaphor of servant is not that metaphor. It's a metaphor which puts front and center the fact that we are committed to practical implications of our relationship with God. And again, the fact that Yerushalmi sees that relationship as central to the words Shema Yisrael, drive home the point that, again, Shema is not just a statement of faith, but the relationship that we are describing. And the point of reiterating that statement twice a day is to make sure that the theory doesn't remain on the level of theory, but comes down to level of action. Okay, I'm going to look quickly. I have a few questions. Okay, first, the slave does not go free in the Shemitah year. Right? The slave goes free either at the end of 6 years. Right? And maybe you mean his personal Shemitah, which is how Rabbi Yosef Karo actually takes it, that this is his personal seven-year cycle. But he goes free in the seventh year. Now, the reason is the wife and children do not go free, so if he was married before, they do go free. But if they were married in the context of the slave relationship, so then they are not really his personal family, so to speak. They are slaves. They're part of the master's household, and this relationship was contrived. I don't know if... perfect word for it. Another question, I don't know who sent this to me, but that's okay. Maiming the ear does not affect the usefulness of the slave. That may be true. That's not the reasons that the Talmud gives. It may be a practical reason, and it's less painful. It's like an ear piercing. That may be true as well. Marriage partners are not equal. Only one can divorce. Only one spouse every day is a primary, with some exception. Okay, that's a longer discussion. But it happens to be that at least at the level of both marriage partners must enter into the relationship willingly, and they both have responsibilities to each other, though they may be different in nature. At that level, marriage is much closer to being equal than the other relationships that we discuss here. The exact equality and the implications for divorce I won't get into now, but it is definitely the closest of the equal relationships, and in the sense that I'm talking about, that entering into the spousal relationship is both must enter of their own volition. That is true for both spouses. Okay, let us jump ahead to the third paragraph of Shema, where we'll see this idea again, and I want to focus on a slightly lengthy passage, not too lengthy. But this is an Agadic statement about tzitzit. And as I mentioned before, the third paragraph of Shema discusses primarily the mitzvah of tzitzit, of the fringes that we put on our four-cornered garments. And though the Talmud says that the reason that we quote this paragraph as part of Shema is not because it talks about tzitzit, but because it talks about Yitziat Mitzrayim. It talks about the exodus from Egypt. Because one of the rationales for the mitzvah tzitzit is that it's a reminder of the relationship with God who took us out of Egypt. Now, I will note before we get into a discussion of tzitzit that, as we already saw in the psukim, in the verses about the slave, the notion that God took us out of Egypt out of servitude to Pharaoh so that we would commit to him completely and become his slaves instead of Pharaoh's, that for the Torah is central to why we commit to him. Right? We don't just commit to God because he created the world, because he is, but because he did something for us personally. And that's how we open the Ten Commandments. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Tzivtecha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Not I am God who created the world, but I am God who took you out of Egypt, and therefore I have the right to command you. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is quoted by his grandson, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, as saying that indeed, the reason that this paragraph appears where it does, the reason that this paragraph that talks about the Exodus is part of Shema, is because remembering that personal miracle, that God took us out of Egypt, is integral to accepting Kabbalat O Malchut Shamayim, is integral to accepting our practical commitment to God. That's why it's here. Because what drives us, what really motivates us to practically commit our lives to God isn't just that we know He exists, but that we know He has a relationship with us personally, that He took us as His children, that He took us out of Egypt, He took us, in the words of Isaiah Berlin, right? He took us, He gave us freedom from, but granted us freedom to, right? He took us out of, right? He took away slavery, which granted us negative freedom, which is freedom from, meaning we were no longer slaves. But when He made us His slaves, He didn't re-enslave us. He gave us freedom to. And Isaiah Berlin describes that there's two types of freedom. There's freedom from, meaning no one's telling you what to do, which is just a negative freedom. It just means you're not controlled. And then there's freedom to, which is that you are free to engage in meaningful activity. And the slavery of God is a freedom to. We become slaves in the sense that we commit to a meaningful lifestyle and are free to engage in that of our own volition. That's what it means to come out of Egypt. That's what it means to have a God who has a personal relationship with us as a nation and as individuals. But according to the Talmud, this type of relationship is manifest in tzitzit. So what I want to do is I'll read it to you in English because it's a bit long. But what I want to do is, if you look all at the end, to make it a little bit easier, I think that the Talmud that we're about to read is set up in a chiastic structure, an ABA or ABCBA structure, which looks like an X, which will really get us to the theme that is coming here. So let's read through it once as a unit, and then we'll talk about it. And again, it's a little bit long, but I want to read through it once. So the Gemara asks, and as for the rabbis, what do they do with this phrase that you may look upon it, meaning look upon the tzitzit, from which Rabbi Shimon derives that a nighttime garment is exempt? The Gemara answers, they require it for that which is taught in a braita. The verse, that you may look upon it and remember, teaches that one should see this mitzvah of ritual fringes of tzitzit and remember another mitzvah that is contingent upon it. And which mitzvah is that? It is the mitzvah of the recitation of Shema. As we learned in the Mishnah, from when may one recite Shema in the morning, from when one can distinguish between the sky blue strings and the white strings on his ritual fringes. So the Talmud first tells us that the tzitzit isn't just the third paragraph of Shema, but the tzitzit itself reminds you of Shema, because the time at which you're allowed to say Shema is from when you can distinguish between the color white and the color blue, and the tzitzit are supposed to have white and sky blue strings. I doubt you can see this in the screen, right? But not everyone wears the blue, but many people believe that we have found the blue, but, right, if you, let's see if we can see it, right? But on my tzitzit, you can see I have, this is the position of the rivet, but I have six white strings, and then two that are sky blue, right? So in pitch black, I could not tell the difference between the strings, but if I were outside in the dark, at the moment at which I could tell which was white and which was blue, so then I would be allowed to say Shema. So by walking outside as the sun is rising with my tzitzit, I would be able to lead into the mitzvah of Shema. So then the Talmud continues. And it is taught in another braita. The phrase that you may look upon it, meaning the tzitzit, and remember, teaches that one should see this mitzvah of ritual fringes and remember another mitzvah that is adjacent into the Torah. And which mitzvah is that? It's the mitzvah of diverse kinds of wool and linen, as it is written, you shall not wear diverse kinds wool and linen together. Okay, we won't get into that law right now. You shall prepare yourself twisted cords. It is taught in another Braita. The verse states that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord. This indicates that once a person is obligated in this mitzvah of ritual fringes, he is obligated in all the mitzvot. The Gemara comments, and this is in accordance with the opinion of Reb Shimon, who says that ritual fringes are a positive time-bound mitzvah and women are exempt, only etc. As I mentioned before, but I don't think we're going to have time to get into that in detail. Skip down a few lines. It is taught in another Braita. The verse states that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord. This teaches that the mitzvah of ritual fringes is equivalent to all the mitzvot of the Torah. Now this is a very strange comment. Why would it be that tzitzit are equivalent to all the mitzvot of the Torah? Now there are many explanations, but I want to focus on one that's going to emerge from the next few lines in the text. And it is taught in another Braita. The verse states that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. This teaches that looking at the ritual fringes leads to remembering the mitzvot, and remembering them leads to doing them. Right? The tzitzit, the point of them is to remember the mitzvot, and you remember the mitzvot, so then you do them. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, anyone who is diligent in this mitzvah of ritual fringes merits receiving the divine presence. Right? It's not just that it's equivalent to all the mitzvot. If you keep tzitzit, you will see God. It is written here that you may look upon it, Oto, and it is written there, you shall fear the Lord your God. Him, Oto, shall you serve. Just as Oto in that verse is referring to the divine presence, so too in this verse is it referring to the divine presence. The sage is taught in a Braita. The Jewish people are beloved, as the Holy One, blessed be He, surrounded them with mitzvot. They have phylacteries on their heads, filin, phylacteries on their arm, ritual fringes on their garments, and a mezuzah on their doorways. Concerning them, David said, seven times a day I praise you because of your righteous ordinances. This alludes to the two phylacteries, the four ritual fringes, and the mezuzah, which total seven. And when David entered the bathhouse and saw himself standing naked, he said, woe to me that I stand naked without any mitzvah. But once he remembered the mitzvah of circumcision of milah that was in his flesh, his mind was put at ease as he realized that he was still accompanied by this mitzvah. After he left the bathhouse, he recited a song about the mitzvah of milah, of circumcision, as it is stated in the verse, for the leader on the Shminit, a psalm of David. This is interpreted as a psalm about circumcision. Okay. Rabbi Lazar ben Yaakov says, anyone who has phylacteries on his head, phylacteries on his arm, ritual fringes on his garment, and mezuzah on his doorway, is strengthened from all sides that he will not sin, as it is stated in the verse, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. This is an interpreted to the allusion of the three mitzvot of phylacteries, ritual fringes, and mezuzah. And the verse states, the angel of the Lord encamps round them that fear him and delivers them. This is interpreted to mean that the angel of the Lord surround those who fill the mitzvot and saves them from sin. It is taught in a Braita that Rabbi Meir would say, what is different about tchelet from all other types of colors, such that it was chosen for the mitzvah of ritual fringes? It's because tchelet is similar to its color to the sea, and the sea is similar to the sky, and the sky is similar to the throne of glory, I mean God's throne, as it is stated, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet like the paved work of sapphire stone, and the like of the very heaven for clearness, indicating that the sky is like a sapphire brickwork. And it is written, the likeness of a throne is the appearance of a sapphire stone. It is taught in a Braita that Rabbi Meir would say, the punishment for not attaching white strings is greater than the punishment for not attaching sky blue strings, despite the fact that the sky blue strings are more important. Rabbi Meir illustrates this with a parable. To what is this matter comparable? It's comparable to a king of flesh and blood who said to his two subjects they must bring him a seal. The king said to him, bring me a seal of clay. And he said to the other one, bring me a seal of gold. And both of them were negligent and did not bring seals. Now these are the seals of slaves. Which of them will have a greater punishment? You must say that it is this one to whom he said, bring me a seal of clay. And despite its availability and low cost, he did not bring it. Okay, I know that was a long piece. And there's a lot going on there. So let's recap. The Talmud tells us that tzitzit is equivalent to all mitzvot. It tells you that if you wear tzitzit, you will remember God. And if you remember God, then you'll act on that, and you'll keep the mitzvot. It tells us that if we wear tzitzit, you'll be able to accept God's presence. It says that if you are surrounded by mitzvot, tzitzit, tefillin, mezuzah, so then you are beloved. That's why God loves you. And then the Talmud goes into this very odd story of King David, who normally was surrounded by mitzvot because he wore tefillin and he had his tzitzit, but then when he went to the bathhouse, suddenly felt bereft of mitzvot and was only comforted when he realized that he had a brit milah. Then the Talmud tells us that if you are surrounded by the mitzvot of tefillin and tzitzit and mezuzah, you'll never sin. Then it tells us that tchelet, the sky blue in our tzitzit, reminds us of the sea, and the sea reminds us of the sky, and the sky reminds us of God. And then it gives us this parable of God telling us to wear a servant to wear a seal, and the seal that's most important is the blue seal. Now, if you just look at all these agadic comments, it really sounds a bit, well, haphazard. It's just, right, a lot of different statements. But if you look at what I put in 15, you'll actually see that there is a very clear logic here. As I said, a chiastic structure, which is an A, B, C, B, A structure, which seems to organize this entire Talmudic passage. So if you look at number 15, I'll make it even bigger so we can focus on it. This section of Agadah, of philosophic comments, starts with this very cryptic statement. Tzitzit, for some reason, is equivalent to all the mitzvot. Now, as I said, I don't know why tzitzit should be equivalent to all the mitzvot. But I think that if you follow the Agadah, you will get your answer. So element 1a of this Talmudic passage is that tzitzit is equivalent to all mitzvot. The second thing, what I'll call 2a part 1, is that seeing the tzitzit reminds you about God, and if you think about God, you'll do the mitzvot. Now that, I think, already provides the first hint, which is that maybe the reason that tzitzit are equivalent to all the mitzvot are not because magically it's equivalent to all the mitzvot, but because it's a reminder to do all the mitzvot, and if you're reminded to do all the mitzvot, and you actually take the reminder to heart, so then you'll keep all the mitzvot. Now, what's the next philosophical comment of the Talmud? That if you wear the tzitzit, you'll be able to accept the divine presence. Now again, you might ask, why are you able to accept the divine presence? So it could be random, but if you follow the structure of the Talmud, it actually makes a lot of sense, which is, tzitzit are equivalent to all mitzvot. Why are they equivalent to all mitzvot? Because when you see the tzitzit, you remember to keep the mitzvot. And if you remember to keep the mitzvot, you'll keep them. The next statement is, if you wear tzitzit, and here I think what the Talmud is saying is, if you take the reminder of the tzitzit to heart and you keep all the mitzvot, so then you'll be able to accept the divine presence. And then the Talmud says, oh, and by the way, if you're the type of person that doesn't just keep tzitzit, but surrounds themselves in mitzvot, tzitzit, tefillin, mezuzah, so then you are especially beloved to God. But then I think the Talmud reverses its chiastic structure. And here's what I call 3b. Because once you say that you are particularly beloved when you surround yourself with mitzvot, you have to ask the question, but what if I can't practically surround myself with mitzvot? And for the Talmud, it's this story about King David. When he was at the bathhouse and he said, well, how am I beloved? I don't have any mitzvot. Answer for him was Brit Milah. Meaning that sometimes you're beloved because you're physically surrounded by mitzvot, but even when you think you're bereft of mitzvot, that's not true, because you're part of a covenant with God, which is represented by the Brit Milah, and therefore you're actually surrounded or committed to mitzvot, whether or not they're physically on your body. And therefore 3b mirrors 3a. Right, 3a says you're beloved because you surround yourself by mitzvot, and 3b answers the question, what if I'm not practically surrounded by mitzvot? But once we've started the mirror image of the Talmud, I think it continues. Because if you remember, this stage was one who wears tzitzit will be able to accept the divine presence. And the next statement in our structure is that Jews who surround themselves with mitzvot will not sin. And I think those are connected. What the Talmud is saying is you wear tzitzit, you'll be able to accept the divine presence. And why is that? So if you look at its mirror image in the Gemara, you'll see the reason is because when you surround yourself by mitzvot, by committing to positives, you also avoid negatives. And if you live a lifestyle committed to the positives of God worship and avoid negatives, so obviously you're the type of person who's going to have a relationship with God. But how you get to be that type of person who does good and avoids bad. So 2b, part b is, Tchelet reminds a person of God. Which is mirroring this section, which is, that seeing our tzitzit reminds us to do the actions, which in turn leads us to doing the actions. And this leads us to what I think is the key to this section. Which is the final image in this Talmudic passage is, that the tzitzit are the sign of a slave. They're like the sign of a slave. Remember the mashal? A master who tells his slave, make sure to come back with the slave of your servitude. And that's like our tzitzit. Now if you look at the structure, 1b, meaning saying that tzitzit is the symbol of our servitude, is parallel to this statement, which is that tzitzit are equivalent to all mitzvot. And therefore, if you look at this structure, this chiastic structure, what I think the Talmud is telling you is as follows. You know what it means that the tzitzit is equivalent to all mitzvot? How is that true? And the answer is, because wearing tzitzit is like putting on yourself the symbol that you have committed to being a slave of God. I.e., you've committed yourself completely to the service of God. If you do that, then obviously that's what it means to keep the mitzvot. Because if you keep the mitzvot piecemeal, so that's very nice, but that's not what a commitment to God is about. What a commitment to God is really about is becoming, quote-unquote, the servant, the slave, which is accepting whatever God says, whenever He says it, is totality. And tzitzit is therefore, if you wear tzitzit, you put it on and you say, I commit to being a servant of God, what you're really doing is saying, I commit to everything, i.e., all mitzvot. And once you put on the tzitzit, and you look down at it, it reminds you and says, hey, you remember? You committed to do what God said because you have a relationship with Him. And when you remember that, you'll act on that. You'll actually live a life of God. And then 2b is, well, if you're acting on that, you're actually doing what God wants you to, it'll go from action to relationship, right? It starts with a basic relationship, meaning I understand I have some relationship with God, I do what He says, but if I actually live that lifestyle, it won't just end with slavery. I'll be mekabel pnei shechinah. I'll have an intimate relationship with God. And what type of relationship? A relationship of love. You'll be beloved because your life will be surrounded by mitzvot all the time. It'll be on your body. It'll be on your house. It'll be everywhere. And the Talmud isn't just, I think, giving us a random collection of statements about tzitzit. It's giving us a philosophy of life. It's saying, wearing tzitzit reminds you that you, part of your relationship with God is the servant relationship, is total commitment. And if you put on that tzitzit and you remember, my commitment to God is total, I'll do whatever He wants, and you look at the tzitzit and allow it to remind you, and you actually live a lifestyle that manifests that, so then you'll be able to enter into a real relationship with God. He will love you. Your entire life will be infused with godliness. And the imagery that kicks it all off is, as I said, servitude, right? And again, servitude, slavery, normally has a negative connotation. I understand that. But in the Torah, as I said, there are a multiplicity of metaphors with which we relate to God. And even in this Talmudic passage, you see how the metaphors play off of each other, which is, if you commit to God totally in the servant relationship, which is maybe not something we would idealize, but if you really commit to that, then it will lead to a lifestyle of complete commitment of mitzvah, which are infused into your life, and then it'll go from a relationship of servitude to a relationship of love. And therefore, as we started with, if Shema, the words of Shema, aren't just, according to the Yerushalmi, a statement that I believe in God, they're a statement that I commit to God, then it's fitting that the third paragraph of Shema should bring in two images that drive that point home. One is by talking about Egypt, which, as we said, is how the Ten Commandments start. God's justification for telling us to do things is, I have a relationship with you. I took you out of Egypt. Keep the mitzvot. And then the next point is tzitzit, the mitzvah, which according to the Gemara is the symbol of our total commitment, which reminds us to constantly be involved in godliness, to avoid bad and commit to good. And therefore, and I'll finish with this and then I'll respond to the questions here, combining this imagery from the third paragraph and the first paragraph, again, I can't say this enough. If we think that Shema is just a statement of theory, of emotion, of psychology, of existential commitment, but it's not meant or doesn't need to manifest itself in the real world, then we've missed the point of Shema. The reason we say Shema every day, day in, day out, morning and night, is because we always need a reminder that to have a relationship with God is to live a relationship with God. Is not just feel it and think it, but do it. And therefore, we say these paragraphs that drive home in different ways. There is a God. We love Him. We have a relationship with Him. And that means surround Him. Surround your life with godliness on your homes, on your body, in what you do and how you talk and how you pray and how you study, in the way you interact with other people. That's what Shema is all about. It's about becoming servants of God, of making that everything in our life is infused with godliness. Now, we have 5 minutes left, so I'll try to answer the questions here. I'll go backwards here. So, as I said at the beginning, obviously, once you talk about the importance of tzitzit, then you have to ask, well, if tzitzit are so important, so then why are women not obligated? Yes. And as I said, it is a very good question, philosophically. And as I said, I won't be able to do it justice, and I do encourage people to look at the link I sent out at the beginning. There's a section there of tzitzit from Derachah. Now, the short answer is that if you go through the Talmud, you'll discover that even in the time of the Talmud, it wasn't actually clear that women were exempt. There are two positions in the Talmud, and there were many positions in the Talmud and in the Tanaitic literature that thought that women were obligated in tzitzit. That's not how we rule legally, but that position existed, which means that the Talmud already thought that it wasn't impossible that this was a mitzvah that was indeed obligated on all. The way the Talmud rules in the end is that, for a technical reason, women are exempt, which is that it's considered time-bound, because you're exempt either at night or on clothes, which are nighttime clothes. But the question of whether women can wear tzitzit, even though they're not obligated, is quite complicated. And while there are certain voices in the Targum Yonatan and elsewhere, that women are not just not obligated, but are in some way fundamentally excluded from tzitzit. Major, major authorities, ranging from Rav Moshe Feinstein to my late teacher, Aaron Lichtenstein, and many others, Rav Elazar Melamud, as a modern example, believe that women, if they choose, can indeed wear tzitzit, meaning it's a technical exemption, but it's not fundamental. They're not excluded from it. It's a technical exemption for whatever reason it is, but if a woman wanted to, she could wear it. Why, even if it is just a technical exemption, why would it be that it would apply to such a fundamental mitzvah? I don't know if I have a great answer. But, as I said, if you look at the piece on Derecha, you will see a long discussion there, and I really do encourage you. That's just the beginning of what I can say. Okay, I got a whole lot of questions here, so let me try to run through them, because I see we have 3 minutes. Okay, I'm going to try to go back to the beginning here. Okay. Yes, Isaiah Berlin is great. I agree. The Hillel story. Yes. I believe it's Rabbi Akiva in the Midrash, but yes, there is a Midrashic story in which taking a bath becomes a mitzvah itself, because if our bodies are created b'tzelem Elokim, that's a fair point, right? That there is a different Midrashic tradition which might provide a different answer, which is that if our bodies are created in the image of God, so then taking a bath and taking care of our physical body might itself be an act of recognizing that God is inherent in our very body. And maybe that is another perspective, right? Maybe the other way of looking at it is that everything we do, as long as we recognize that every act, no matter how physical, can represent the godliness inherent in ourselves, that may be another way of looking at how we're never bereft of mitzvot. I like that idea. I think it's beautiful. Another thought. Yes. Now, the other irony is that tzitzit, as important as the Gemara makes it out to be, it's not a mitzvah that you're actually obligated to do. It's what's called a mitzvah kiyumit. It's only a mitzvah that if you wear a four-cornered garment, so then you have to wear tzitzit. But if you choose not to wear a four-cornered garment, on a biblical level, you don't need to wear tzitzit. That is also a very good question. It's not clear why that should be with a mitzvah as important as tzitzit, but we don't really. But it is a very good question. The Gemara happens to say that even though you're technically exempt, you should try to wear a four-cornered garment, which may go a little bit towards answering that question. Women have no brit. Okay, I'm not sure the exact connection of brit milah to tzitzit. It does seem to be inherent in this Gemara, but I really don't know what to do with it. I agree that seems to be part of the Gemara here, but I don't know exactly what to do with it. Yes, the David story does create some issues in Birkat HaMazon, which is discussed in the Gemara in Brachot. Yes, the first paragraph of Shema does talk about unconditional commitments. That is true. The second one seems to be more conditional. That may be because the first paragraph doesn't mention reward and punishment. The second paragraph comes to reinforce it, which is, in addition to the fact that you have to keep the mitzvot, if you don't, there are consequences, which seems to be what drives the conditional language in the second paragraph. I think there's more to it, but that would be the beginning of it. Okay. I'm going to stay on for questions, but let me just wrap up for 30 seconds. Thank you to Torah in Motion. It's been a lot of fun to, as I said, re-examine central texts of our liturgy and tease out the philosophical ideas and what they tell us about our lifestyle. Shema obviously has a tremendous amount in it, considering how central it is to our lives and to Jewish philosophy and Jewish life. I really thank all of you for coming because, you know, it's the best way for me to really learn is to discuss it and teach it. And reinforce the ideas in myself. As some of you already know, because you've taken me up on this, I am always happy to follow up with questions that I didn't get a chance to deal with in depth here. My email is on the source sheets. If you can't find it, it's probably on the Torah in Motion website. You can get it. I will respond, not necessarily right away, but I do try in a timely fashion to respond to emails. Some of you have already emailed me about this series, and I really do enjoy follow-up questions. Obviously, each of these shiurim, we covered a few key ideas, and each idea that we addressed opens up 1,000 more ideas. So I hope you have more questions. And like I said, I really do encourage you to follow up with me, and I hope at least this got you thinking about what it means to commit to God, to love God, what we're trying to do with Shema. And since we say this twice a day, I hope it reinforces and deepens and makes your religious experience more beautiful. I'll stick around for some more questions, but I really, like I said, yes. Thank you, Chaim, for putting my email there. It's now in the chat. But yes, please, and yes, fill out the survey on, reminder, fill out the survey. But yes, really, I do follow up to emails, so do feel free to follow up with me at my email. I will try to get back to you. Obviously, as I said, I have opened several cans of worms. I know that. So I do look forward to following up with you. And thank you for coming and learning with me. And that is it for this official series.
Cans of worms are great. It's always good to open up cans of worms.
Yes.
That's how we learn. Okay. I mean, if I can say that. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure. And thank you for Rabbi Ziering. And, you know, he was in Toronto for 3 years. He benefited from that. And he comes to visit. He used to come to visit. He's got to
One day.
Would very much like to see the grandchildren, I'm sure.
Yes.
I can say so. And to see you, of course, and we'd like to see you. Thank you very much. Tomorrow morning, of course, we on the home stretch, Megillat Esther, the last of the five Megillot, or Davneri, that's tomorrow, Tanakh series, 11 o'clock. Then we get into Ezra, Nehemiah, Daniel, and Dibrei HaYamim to finish up the series. I hope to see you. And tomorrow night, Mark Shapiro continues his series on his book. And we're working. We have already two classes on our quote-unquote Elul Yamim Noraim series. So hopefully within a couple of days, you'll get an email about that. We'll do another registration, just sort of the clear system that was in for Elul. And we look forward to learning with you. And that's why we put the survey. If you have any ideas, we do take it seriously. So please let us know. And thank you very much. And thank you for being online. And now if anybody has any questions, you can unmute yourself
and for people who wanted to see it, again, I put the link earlier, but I just pulled it up on the screen. This is the website that I really do think is excellent. I really do encourage it. Derachea by Lori Novick, right? Women and Mitzvot. And as you can see here on the constant section, right, it has a discussion of tzitzit, of tefillin, all types of other issues, seasonal mitzvot. You know, they have a podcast, they have... On each thing, they have the philosophical issues as well as the halachic ones. I really think it's a excellently done website, the best of its kind out there. And for the several people who asked about the women's issues, I really do encourage looking there. And they really do respond. If you ask them a question on the Q&A, Lori Novick and the other people who are involved with it, Rachel Weber and others, they will get back to you. They are excellent. They are friends. And they specifically told me that I should tell, Lori specifically told me that when I'm giving this shiur, I should tell you and give a shout out to Derachea so she knows that people might reach out to her, so she is ready and waiting. So really do feel free to reach out to her. She's really excellent.
She created the whole thing on her own, and she has given a couple classes on Zoom for us.